From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Four U.S. cities got the green light to bid for the 2024 Summer Olympics. Ahead on Only a Game, San Francisco, L.A., Boston, and Washington, D.C. reach for the rings. Also, the Mavericks add a key piece to their NBA title quest, a conversation with four-time NBA champ Horace Grant, the life, the loves, and the many wrestling intrigues of Panther Girl, and how Andrew Luck baffles gridiron opponents with sincere and heartfelt compliments. Also ahead, golf course construction flourishes in China despite a government ban and social pressure for citizens to just stay off the links.
In 2004, China had around 176 golf courses. Since the moratorium went into effect, no other country has built more golf courses than China.
Stay tuned. The United States Olympic Committee this week announced that it will bid to host the Summer Olympic Games in 2024. San Francisco, Boston, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C. are all vying to be the USOC's choice, and their proposals contain terms not traditionally associated with the Olympics, terms like sustainable and affordable. Only a Game's Kurt Nickisch was at the USOC meeting this week outside San Francisco to find out how the four contending U.S. cities plan to wow the world on the cheap.
Teams from the four cities made their presentations on Tuesday to the U.S. Olympic Committee board behind closed doors.
We put on a great presentation. I think on a scale of 1 to 10, we put on 11.
That's Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, who pitched the first walkable Olympics. The city says it won't build a single new parking space other than for the disabled. Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti wouldn't go that far, but says he's proud to offer, quote, sustainable and affordable games. San Francisco's plan calls for a pop-up Olympic stadium that would be taken apart and recycled. Washington, D.C. wants to use mostly existing venues. USOC Chairman Larry Probst says this is exactly what the International Olympic Committee, or IOC, is asking for.
What the IOC is trying to do is make this process more cost-effective, more efficient, and they want to see bids that harmonize the long-term plans of the city with the Olympic Games. And so that's perceived as a very positive thing by all of the cities that we're considering.
The IOC announced these changes earlier this month to try to get more cities to bid for the Olympics. It's responding to the backlash at costly games that leave host cities with empty venues. Russia spent more than $50 billion on the Sochi Games, and the Bird's Nest Stadium in Beijing has become a white elephant. Avoiding boondoggles like those is encouraging to Probst.
And we think that we've got four great candidate cities. We think it's our time to move forward with a bid. We think we're optimistic about our opportunity to compete with other cities around the world.
There's no stronger signal than the IOC president saying, we want the Americans to bid.
That's USA Today's Nancy Armour, who has covered the Olympics since 1996, the last time the U.S. hosted the Summer Games. She says this is a significant turnaround. New York lost its bid for the 2012 Olympic Games. In 2009, President Obama showed up in Copenhagen only to see Chicago's 2016 bid voted out in the first round of balloting. 4 years ago, the U.S. did not even submit a bid. But Armour says Probst has worked hard to repair his staff's relationship with the IOC.
They can make a bid knowing for sure that there is no chance that they will be embarrassed like they were in the 2016 or the 2012 votes. That will not happen again.
The USOC also feels good about timing. When 2024 rolls around, it will have been 28 years since the U.S. last hosted the Summer Games in Atlanta. So it may be the United States' turn.
Now, you know, the other cities in the race can make that same statement.
Robert Livingstone handicaps the competition for the bid on his website, gamesbids.com.
Paris bid three times recently and lost all three, so they think it's their turn. You've got a city from South Africa that might be bidding. The Games have never been to Africa, so they think it's their turn. So it's going to be a race. Nobody's guaranteed to win it.
And with the IOC calling for cheaper bids, more cities may be getting into the race. Rome is already in. Berlin may bid. Istanbul and Melbourne are also in the picture. In early January, the USOC will choose between L.A., Washington, D.C., Boston, and San Francisco. Let the games begin. For Only a Game, I'm Kurt Nickisch.
This season, the NFL has been dogged by domestic abuse scandals, a DEA investigation into painkiller abuse, and, of course, the ever-present worries about long-term damage caused by concussions. So maybe it's not surprising that when a report surfaced this week about Indianapolis Colts quarterback Andrew Luck, the sports world stood up and took notice. The Wall Street Journal's Kevin Clark is the investigator who uncovered the truth about Mr. Luck. Kevin, your report accused Andrew Luck of some pretty unusual behavior. Describe his on-the-field demeanor for me, please.
He is unlike anybody in football in that when he gets hit, and when he gets hit hard, he congratulates the person who did it. He gets sacked quite a bit, actually, this year. And his customary thing is to get up and say, "Hey, great job," or "What a hit." And the defenders who have encountered this sort of behavior have no idea what to do with it, but he does it constantly. There is no defender who hasn't levied a big hit against Mr. Luck and not been congratulated.
My favorite detail from your piece comes from Washington linebacker Ryan Kerrigan, who described his sack of Andrew Luck. That sack resulted in a fumble, so Luck was a little too busy to offer his congratulations right away. But that wasn't the end of the story, right?
No, so Kerrigan sacks Luck. Luck loses the ball. He can't really talk to Kerrigan after the play. That's sort of the end of it. However, Andrew Luck looped around later in the game to congratulate him on the sack and say, "You know, you're doing a great job today." And Kerrigan had no clue what to do with that. The idea that Luck would seek him out later in the game while the game was going on. Kerrigan spoke about this, and one of the things he said was that after it happened, he was so confused, he found Trent Murphy, who played with Luck at Stanford and now plays for Washington. He found him on the sideline and said, "What is Andrew Luck doing?" And Trent Murphy responded, "Yeah, that's kind of his thing."
Within hours of the publication of your story, sports news organizations were quoting you and asking other NFL players for reaction. Why do you think a silly story about a polite quarterback has gotten such an incredible response?
I can't put my finger on it. This is probably the most popular story that we've had since I joined the NFL beat in 2012. I can't understand it. I think that it's because, A, I don't think a lot of people know a lot about Andrew Luck, so they want to learn about him. He's a rising star. This is his third season, and I think he's, you know, destined to be the best quarterback in the NFL in 4 or 5 years. I also think it's just different. The NFL has gotten so hammered, but there's still a lot of people who love the NFL despite the domestic violence problems and the DEA investigation and all the things the NFL has screwed up this year. There's still a little bit of goodness in the NFL, and this kind of nerdy guy who's just way too nice and, you know, quite frankly, probably too nice for the NFL. The fact that this person exists, I think, really excites people.
Is it possible that Andrew Luck is behaving this way because he wants people to figure, "Oh, man, I can't hit that guy again"?
That is possible. One thing that got cut from the story, which I think is the best theory, is that Nolan Carroll, the defensive back for the Eagles, who told the story of you know, rushing Luck from the edge and hearing, "Great job, Nolan," and just sort of spinning around because he was looking for who it was because it couldn't possibly be the quarterback, and then it was the quarterback, okay? He told that story, but he said he thinks that Luck does it because he loves the game and because he's a very nice guy, but there's about 20% of him that wants you to know that he's going to get off the turf and he's going to throw a touchdown on the next play. I don't think he's trying to bait them into being nicer. I think he's trying to let you know, "I am a mountain."
You can link to Kevin Clark's Wall Street Journal story, "Andrew Luck, the NFL's Most Perplexing Trash Talker," at onlyagame.org. Kevin, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much.
This year's edition of the Edmonton Oilers is a dismal 7-20-6. On Monday, the team fired head coach Dallas Eakins, who in less than a year and a half at the helm had posted a 36-63-14 record. Problem solved, right? Well, not according to Edmonton Journal sports columnist John McKinnon, who maintains that the once-proud Oilers are, quote, "a mess of monumental proportions." John, was it the performance of the players, the coaching staff, or the team's front office that led you to that rather bleak assessment?
Well, all of the above, and this has been developing over a long period of time. This season they're on track to miss the playoffs for the 9th straight year, which is one season shy of the NHL record, which is 10, held by the Florida Panthers, and people are impatient, to say the least. It's a mixture of virtually every aspect of their organization.
The Oilers have had top 10 picks in the first round of the last 6 NHL drafts, including 3 consecutive number one picks. Is the team's ability to assess talent lacking, or have the Oilers simply been unlucky and drafted a bunch of guys over the last 6 years who were stiffs?
Well, both. But I think that their drafting of the high-end talent has been, by and large, astute. Taylor Hall is an excellent player, although currently I think he's got 11 games without scoring a goal. Ryan Nugent-Hopkins is a fine centerman. So they do have difficulty eyeballing talent sort of at the mid-levels. But for the high-end talent, I think they've done fine.
How have Oilers fans reacted to the mess their team is in these days?
Well, in the competing newspaper to ours, a tabloid paper, the Edmonton Sun, there's a full-page ad taken out by anonymous people, mind you, and they sort of see a lack of accountability dating back to Kevin Lowe's time as general manager. So the fans are very impatient, and they're expressing it. I mean, that full-page ad is one thing. Somebody bought a billboard and put a similar thing, fire Kevin Lowe, on a billboard within the last month or so. So they express themselves, and there are more and more empty seats at the games.
Would things seem so bleak and would the fans be so dismayed were it not for the amazing run of 5 Stanley Cup championships in 7 seasons back in the 80s that Edmonton achieved?
Well, I think people here would be upset regardless. However, that is central to everything, yes. The history here of excellence is both a blessing and a curse for the Edmonton Oilers. On October 10th, this season, they invited back the entire 1984 Edmonton Oilers team, and they all came. That was the first team in Edmonton to win the Stanley Cup. That was the first of their 5. And they all came in, and they had a big night at the Rexall Place, you know, with people telling stories, and Sarah McLachlan came and sang, you know, I Will Remember You, and it was a very emotional and very pleasant evening, and the team started the season by losing 5 straight games. So on the one hand, they're selling the excellence and selling the memories and selling Wayne Gretzky, and well, they should. I mean, how many franchises have that to, sell? On the other hand, the present is a pale imitation of what they had.
You know, I was going to close this conversation by asking you how long you thought it would take before the Oilers were once again contenders, but I think instead I'll just ask how long you think it'll be before they aren't terrible.
Publicly enunciated that virtually every aspect of their organization needs to be examined thoroughly, if not completely overhauled. The team is playing with basically 2 career backup goalies. Their defense core is young and not yet mature enough to really be impactful. And up front, they're thin at center. They're weak everywhere. I wouldn't expect them to really be decent until 2-3 years down the road.
John MacKinnon is a columnist for the Edmonton Journal. You can link to his article, Edmonton Oilers, a mess of monumental proportions, by visiting onlyagame.org. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
The Dallas Mavericks are thinking win now. The Boston Celtics are thinking win later. And with those things in mind, the teams completed a 5-player deal on Thursday that sent point guard and 4-time NBA All-Star Rajon Rondo to the Mavericks. Joining me now to discuss the deal is Only a Game's Doug Tribou. Hello, Doug.
Hi, Bill.
Let's start with the details of the trade.
Well, the big star name here is Rondo for Dallas. Boston's getting guard Jameer Nelson, forward Jay Crowder, and Brandon Wright, a big man from Dallas. But the stars for them will probably be these draft picks, one for the first round in 2015 and another for the second round in 2016.
The Mavericks won the only championship in franchise history back in 2011. Some of the core players from that team are on the Dallas roster today, including future Hall of Famer Dirk Nowitzki and center Tyson Chandler. What does the addition of Rondo give the Mavs?
Rondo gives them a top-flight point guard who can distribute to all of these guys on the Mavs offense who can score. They have Monte Ellis, who is scoring more than 20 points a game this season. They've got Nowitzki. They have a whole host of players that can put the ball in the hoop. They need a guy to get it to them. And when they won that title, they had Jason Kidd. Jason Kidd could pass, and he could rebound, something unusual for a small point guard. Rondo is the same way. He is excellent in both of those categories. He doesn't need to score, which is sort of his weak point with an erratic jump shot. But when he is distributing the ball, this offense, I think, is going to get better.
The Celtics had named Rondo the 15th captain in team history last year. How is he going to fit into a team that's loaded with star power already?
That'll be interesting to watch. Rondo was very young when he won a title with the new big three in Boston with Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, and Ray Allen. Now he's a veteran. He was in this captaincy role, this leadership role, and he's coming into a well-established franchise. I think he'll fit in because he's got strong personalities around him, and they're very likely to be in the running for a title at some point in the next year or two if he stays there.
The Mavericks had a 19-8 record when this trade was announced. How much better do they have to be to contend?
That's the trouble with the Western Conference. 19-8 is just good for sixth in the Western Conference at the time of the trade. If the Dallas Mavericks were in the Eastern Conference, only one team, Toronto, would have more wins than they do. So the Mavs, to keep up, feel like they have to have a win-now mentality. And Dirk Nowitzki's 36. Tyson Chandler is 32. The window for them to win a second title with this core group is closing, and they're making a run at it.
Boston, of course, in a very different situation. Kevin Garnett, Ray Allen, and Paul Pierce long gone. The Celtics were awful last year. They haven't been much better this year. What are the short-term and long-term impacts of this trade for Boston?
The short-term impact is that they are much less watchable. They just lost the only must-watch guy on the floor, Rajon Rondo. In the long-term, this is part of the rebuilding process. This is the new NBA. Get rid of your stars after the success is over and start from the ground up. That's what they're doing. They hope the picks turn into something, and they're hoping for success 2, 3, 4 years down the road. These guys they've gotten will not be in Boston for long.
That's Only a Game's Doug Tribou with an assist on breaking down the Rajon Rondo trade. Doug, thank you very much.
I see what you did there, Bill.
On Thursday, as part of the NBA's annual five-game Christmas Day schedule, the Chicago Bulls will host the Los Angeles Lakers at the United Center. That's where Michael Jordan scored most of his 32,000-plus points that left him third on the NBA's all-time scoring list. But on Sunday, Kobe Bryant bumped Jordan down to fourth. When the Lakers and Bulls meet, you can excuse Horace Grant if he has trouble picking sides. Grant earned 3 championships with the Bulls and another with the Lakers during an NBA career that went from 1987 to 2004. Horace Grant joins me now. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much for having me, Bill.
You played on title-winning teams with both Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant. In your view, what's the biggest similarity between the two and the biggest difference between the two players?
The similarities are the work ethic that they both had and have. Very competitive people. They make their teammates better. Once they feel that they need to take over a game, that light comes on and they carry the team.
Well, what about differences between them?
I mean, I think the 3 years that Michael was in college helped groom him a little better in terms of dealing with the media and people. Hmm. Kobe, he didn't trust anyone, even in the beginning. And that kind of rubbed people, some people, the wrong way. But once you got to know that young man, he was, I mean, an incredible, incredible person.
You played in 170 playoff games. There are only 20 players in NBA history who've played in more. Chicago finally has Derrick Rose back from injuries. Bulls fans hope that he'll bring home the first title since the Jordan era. Do you see the drive and the will to win in Rose that you saw in Michael Jordan and in Kobe Bryant?
Oh, most definitely. I truly think when healthy, he's one of the toughest kids, young men I've seen since Michael and Kobe in terms of the passion, the drive, the love of the game of basketball. And with the crew around him and the addition of Paul Gasol, I think they have a great, great chance of bringing that championship back to Chicago.
You averaged more than 11 points a game during your career, and you played with 4 of the top 10 scorers of all time, Bryant and Jordan, who we've mentioned, Shaq, who's 6th all-time on the list, and Karl Malone, who's 2nd behind Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. It's amazing, isn't it, that you managed to get into double figures with those guys taking so many shots?
Well, Bill, that's when you have to reach down and become a pretty good offensive rebounder. You know, playing with those guys, you're not going to get many shots. I mean, I had to figure it out sooner or later that, you know, you're not getting the ball. So get it off the offensive boys and put it back in.
It sounds like maybe there were nights where you kind of wished they would miss so that board would be there.
Well, I can't say that publicly.
Your twin brother Harvey also played in the NBA, and his son, your nephew Jeremy, is a rookie on the Philadelphia 76ers. This year, the Sixers are on a pace to have the worst record in league history. You only missed the playoffs a few times in your career. Have you talked with your nephew about adjusting to the NBA and dealing with what looks like a really tough season?
I text him, and I just tell him to keep his head up high and, you know, don't get down on the season. Keep working hard, and in the offseason, you know, that's when players are made.
Setting aside your 17-year career, more than 9,000 career rebounds, four NBA titles, you rank high on another list, the best NBA players to ever wear goggles during games. Is it true that you didn't know you were legally blind until a couple of years after you reached the NBA?
It's so funny that I passed the physical for the Bulls, hearing and eyesight. You know, Phil Jackson always gave us books. So one night after a game on the bus, I'm reading a book, and I had the book like 3 inches away from my face, and Johnny Bock, who was one of our defensive assistants, said, "You need to get your eyes checked again." The next day, I go in, and I'm legally blind. Legally blind. That week, the goggles were born.
This program is produced in Boston, but I'm still going to mention that when you were with Orlando, you scored the very last basket at the old Boston Garden in a playoff game that ended the Celtics' 94-95 season. So, old arenas, new arenas, Jordan, Kobe, NBA expansion. Your career bridged two significant eras in NBA history. I wonder if you noticed that that was the case while it was happening.
No, I think I was just caught up in the moment of loving the game of basketball and doing whatever I need to do out there on the court. But, you know, whenever you go inside of the old Boston Garden or Madison Square Garden or the old Forum, all of that tradition, I mean, you can't help but to think about it, but you can't let it overtake the goal while you're there. I mean, it was a humbling experience to play in such great arenas.
Horace Grant is a four-time NBA champion, and he has traveled the world as one of the league's goodwill ambassadors. Horace, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're very welcome, Bill.
Horace Grant may be on the books as the last NBA player to score an official basket at the old Boston Garden, but he wasn't the last person to make a shot before they took up the parquet for the last time and shut the building down. That's a very different story, and I know because I was there. After our interview, I told Horace Grant about it and explained that if fans asked him about that final basket, he'd have to add an asterisk to his place in history.
I will make sure I tell them that.
To read an account of the Boston Garden's final baskets, visit onlyagame.org. Building a golf course is hard work. Building one in a country where course construction is against the law is even harder work, and that's one of several challenges Dan Washburn explores in his new book, The Forbidden Game, Golf and the Chinese Dream. Dan Washburn, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
How did it happen that the construction of golf courses came to be forbidden in China?
Well, the most recent moratorium on golf course construction came about in 2004. Beijing issued a ban on it, citing an out-of-control real estate market and the illegal seizure of farmland, both very valid concerns. But what they did was they instituted this ban and, in effect, turned their backs and let this thing that they were supposedly trying to stop grow even more out of control. So in 2004, according to state media, China had around 176 golf courses. Since the moratorium went into effect, no other country has built more golf courses than China. And right now there's anywhere between 600 and 1,000. No one knows exactly how many because it was so unregulated. A few years ago, the government started looking at satellite photos to try to get a handle on the number of golf courses in the country.
Well, you say officials turned their back, but they sort of turned their back and then stuck their hands out behind their back, right? Because there was some corruption involved in the building of these courses.
Yeah, more than some. So, I mean, there's the disconnect between Beijing and the local governments out in the provinces. There's an old saying, the mountain is high and the emperor is far away, that kind of sums up this situation. So the local governments, in many cases, they actually wanted this kind of development. they thought that a golf course would attract business, would attract a well-heeled clientele. But perhaps most important, the local governments wanted these land-hungry developments because they're the ones that own the land, and they profit mightily from these land deals. That's where a lot of the tensions arise, because the villagers who may have to give up some of this land know that the government is lining its pockets and they're getting a very small percentage.
Just 3 weeks ago, the PGA Tour China held its last event of 2014. To what extent has that become a popular event in the country?
I think it's more important for the development of Chinese golfers than it is for the development of Chinese fans of the game. And when I say Chinese golfers, I'm not talking about recreational golfers. Now that golf is an Olympic sport, we all know that China is more than a little crazy about Olympic medals. The government is starting to pay some attention to the game, and they want to get as many Chinese golfers competing in the Olympics as possible. The way you do that is by attaining world ranking points, and the only way you can do that is by competing on international tournaments. So the PGA Tour in China, it's a way that PGA can get its foot in the door in a market they view as the next big thing. But for China, it's a way for golfers to earn these valuable world ranking points and get their names on the Olympic radar.
You have written that Chinese politicians would register at golf courses, I gather, for their tee times using fake names. Does that still go on?
I would say golf is even more politically taboo today than it was when I started writing the book. For a government official to be tied to the game in a public manner would earn the label of being corrupt. And in today's political climate in China, you know, there's a big corruption crackdown going on. So I would say, you know, you might see even fewer Chinese officials registering under fake names these days because of the tense situation that's happening there.
There's a great story in The Forbidden Game about how a peasant turned golf course security guard took up the game of golf. Tell us about Zhou Shunshu, and don't leave out the first time he hit a golf ball.
Yeah, I think Zhou is really the ultimate underdog, and his inspiring story is really at the heart of the book. He grew up in a very poor mountain village. He gets a job as a security guard at a golf course, but he was forbidden to play because he was a lowly security guard. So he devised, kind of in secret, a way that he could try this game. And the moment that you mentioned, he was at the driving range at the golf club that he worked at, and the upper staff of the golf club, they were trying to hit this ball over the 225-yard marker at the end of the driving range. And nobody could do it. Joe was watching on, as he often did, and he said, "Hey, can I have a try?" And imagine, this is his first time ever hitting a golf ball. But he reared back and swung. He hit nothing the first three times, and people were starting to jeer him. And he focused all of his energy, reared back and swung, and it went long and straight and went over the hill. And from then on, he thought, maybe I can do something in this game.
Joe started playing with golf balls that he found in the woods and with discarded clubs that he had to rebuild. You watched him play a good deal for this book. How good has he become?
Well, you know, at his prime, he was one of the top 20 golfers in China, which is remarkable for a guy who came from where he did. He rose to be among the best of his generation.
Your book has been characterized as going well beyond golf. How did the sport present you with the opportunity to explore the contradictions in contemporary China?
Technically, 0% of the Chinese population plays golf. But the rise of golf is a barometer for China's economic growth. But it's also a topic that allows you to discuss other issues very important to modern China. Rural land rights disputes, kind of Wild West scenario that surrounds it, the gap between rich and poor, plenty of corruption and political intrigue. And then in the case of each one of the men featured in my book, it shows how these new developments in a changing China can for some be a vehicle for them to try to attain at least one definition of what may be known as the Chinese dream.
Dan Washburn is the author of The Forbidden Game, Golf and the Chinese Dream, and he joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Dan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on Only a Game, Panther Girl. I could say more about that, but I think I'll just leave it to your imagination. Anyway, first I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
I saw both versions of Cat People, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
No, you don't. No, you don't. But anyway, the Arizona Cardinals will attempt to clinch the NFC's top seed with a win over the Seattle Seahawks on Sunday night. The experts seem to think they will not succeed. Do you think that has anything to do with the fact that the Cardinals are on starting quarterback number three?
You can't have a worse year than these guys have had for injuries. Yeah, Ryan Lindley will be leading the Arizonas into this crucial contest. I don't know. I mean, if they're smart, they'll just keep handing the ball to Kerwin Williams and let him run for 190 yards. I mean, they are very lucky the game's at home, but I don't really see him being Seattle in this situation.
With their Monday night win over the Chicago Bears, the New Orleans Saints have the best record in the NFC South. And what
a record
it is.
And they're so proud.
Yeah.
And they're so proud. Their record is 6-8. And I'm no mathematician, but I occasionally play one on the radio, Bill, and I'll tell you that that's below 500.
In this world of making the playoffs, how much does that matter?
It doesn't at this point. The hell of it all, of course, is that there is a theoretical possibility that the Saints will win their division at 7-9. And either Seattle or Green Bay won't make the playoffs.
The FCC has ruled that the name of the NFL team that plays in Washington, D.C. is not, in fact, profane. Does this mean broadcasters will once again start saying that name on the air?
Well, no, they didn't stop saying it because it was profane. They said they stopped saying it because it's an obvious racial slur. This was a long shot for the people fighting to get the Redskins' name changed. The FCC wasn't going to rule any other way. It's not profane. I mean, it's insensitive and racist and awful, but it's not profane.
Coaches, of course, are hired to be fired. Everybody knows that, and most coaches have the grace to accept getting fired when it happens. Not so, apparently, the former Nebraska football coach, Bo Pelini.
And more to the point, the current Youngstown State football coach, Bo Pelini. Yeah, Bo Pelini was 40 games over 500 during his time at Nebraska, so it wasn't the coaching. It was his volatile personality. Ha! Says I. If you thought he was volatile when he had the job, you should have seen what he did once they took it away from him. He went off at a meeting of his players and called the athletic director at Nebraska all kinds of names we can't say on the radio because they're more profane than Redskins is. But suffice it to say that Bo is apparently not softened in his step down to Youngstown State.
Former Boston Celtics point guard Rajon Rondo is the newest star for the Dallas Mavericks. Dallas sports writers seem to be exceedingly giddy over his acquisition. Is their optimism well-founded?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is a loaded team right now, and Rajon Rondo is exactly what they need. The Celtics got a bunch of draft picks and, you know, some spare parts for him. It's too bad. I really wished he'd stayed, but he was coming up on his option year. Obviously, the rebuilding is going to take longer than he has the patience for. He gave them a tremendous career from virtually out of nowhere in the draft, and anybody who slanders him on the way out the door doesn't know anything about basketball.
No surprises in women's college basketball.
Oh, yes,
this week,
there is.
Right? South Carolina, right there at the top of the AP poll.
Who let these people in?
I couldn't wait to give you that one.
Seriously? What's UConn doing in second place? This will change, by the way, by the end of the year, I'm just saying.
In the spirit of the season, various NHL teams had planned to visit children's hospitals this week, Charlie. Those plans have been postponed. What, are teams worried the kids might infect the players with some awful disease?
No, it's because the NHL players have turned into germ-ridden disease factories, Bill.
At least as far as mumps is concerned.
Everybody's got the mumps.
Yeah.
The Islanders were supposed to go to 6 hospitals. They didn't go. The Flames were going to go to a hospital. They didn't go. The Hurricanes and the Minnesota Wild, none of them did. I have a feeling we're going to see lots of kids visiting, like, NHL players in the hospital after the first of the year.
All right. Charlie, for years, you have maintained that the future of Major League Baseball expansion should be in Cuba. And this week, it became apparent.
It's the day of Jubilee, Bill.
That you have the ear of the President of the United States.
It's the day of Jubilee. My team is not far away. Pretty soon, I will be sitting in my own luxury box at Minute Maid Vincentimo Stadium the ocean in Havana.
And will the team be the reconstituted Havana Sugar Kings?
Or they have to be. There's no question. Unless we bring back the International League team somewhere in Cuba and make them the Sugar Kings. If not, it is definitely the Havana Sugar Kings. And everyone, Bill, everyone, we're going to have Borsellino Hat Day. Half price if you're wearing a Borsellino hat. Cigar stands at the concession stands. Food from the Caribbean at all the food courts, and 50-cent bleacher seats for any child under the age of 15 who comes from any nation in the Caribbean basin.
When he was general manager of the Red Sox, Theo Epstein once left Fenway Park in a gorilla suit in order to avoid the media. What sort of animal-related shenanigans is he up to as general manager of the Cubs?
He told a local broadcast outlet in Chicago, they asked him how badly he wanted to sign John Lester, and he said, "I was ready to soak myself in deer urine if necessary."
I'm not sure how that would help.
Well, it would help because no coyotes would be chasing you while, you know. No, actually, it wouldn't help, would it? Because the coyotes would chase you. Theo needs to rethink this plan because he's going to have terrible trouble with coyotes.
In any case, the plan worked.
Don't worry out there, folks. You can shake Theo's hand sometime in July.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland. And he joins me each week as well on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie, and happy holidays.
Hey, happy holidays to everybody out there, too. And thanks for listening and listen to us in the new year because there'll be more of this wonderful silliness. Happy New Year and Merry Christmas.
In a jealous world full of angry wrestling midgets, crooked promoters, and bitter love triangles, who would want Panther Girl dead? That's the question at the heart of Jeff Mache's Victory Journal profile of Ann Casey, the wrestler known as Panther Girl. Casey was a contender for the U.S. women's title in 1973 when she was gunned down at an intersection in Mississippi. Jeff, before we get to the attempted murder, please tell us about pro wrestling back in the 60s and 70s. Was it anything like today's spectacle?
We have female wrestlers today, but back in the late 1960s and early 1970s, it was like the Wild West. Anything could happen, anything did happen, and the ring was a quite dangerous place.
Ann Casey grew up on a farm in Alabama, but her life took a strange turn when she met the woman known as the Fabulous Moolah, then the U.S. women's wrestling champion. What role did the Fabulous Moolah play in Casey's development as a wrestler?
Well, Moolah wasn't just a wrestler. She managed every female wrestler in the States. And when Moolah discovered Ann Casey, who was working in the box office in Mobile, Alabama, she took one look at her figure, this farm girl figure, and told her, you know, I can make you a star.
Is it fair to say, though, that Moolah began treating her rising star unfairly almost from the start?
Well, Moolah had a reputation as a money grabber, hence the nickname. Hmm. She was famous for taking a very heavy cut out of her wrestler's money. And she did that with Ann Casey, who was on the road wrestling, really earning pennies on the dollar. At the time, she was a single mother trying to feed her kid.
Casey eventually left the Fabulous Moolah. How was it that she began working undercover for the police?
According to Ann Casey's autobiography, she discovered that her son might have been involved with drugs and drug trafficking. She decided to turn the family member in to the police, who offered her a deal. Use your wrestling travels as a cover to work for us. Well, the drug dealers that she was working to crack down on were quite kind of serious guys. They discovered her undercover motives, and in 1973, she was shot six times while she was waiting at a stoplight.
That part of the story verges on impossible to believe because her injuries were such that it's very hard to see how she could drive herself to the hospital, let alone finally survive. Tell me a little bit about that.
I tracked down the surgeon that fixed her up, and he confirmed to me the extent of her injuries. He also told me that if she hadn't have been in such peak physical condition, she would have died almost on the spot.
And yet, Ann Casey not only survived, she wrestled again. How did she do once she had come back to the ring?
Well, she once again found herself in poverty because wrestling was all she knew. And although the doctors told her that she should never step inside the ring again, she returned to the ring and found that her injury somehow made her body stronger. And there was one thing she really wanted, and that was to win the U.S. women's title. So when she was given a chance to fight for that belt, she took it. She did take the title and did get to drive away with the belt, which for her was an extremely happy ending.
But you didn't leave the story with the ending of Ann Casey becoming the champ. You found out what she's up to these days. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, you wouldn't believe me if I told you, but her life after wrestling is almost as unbelievable as her life in the ring. She married a death row prisoner, and he got involved in an accident during a prison rodeo, and he was paralyzed. So the state of Mississippi decided to release him. He made a miraculous recovery, and Ann Casey says he ran off with her sister.
This story is past believing, and it was past believing even before those last few elements entered it.
Exactly, which is why I continued the story on.
Jeff Maish is a long-form journalist from Los Angeles, and you can link to his piece, The Legend of Panther Girl, at our website, onlyagame.org. Jeff, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Boxers traditionally hail from working-class backgrounds, but the sport has always attracted a white-collar audience. In recent years, some of those fans have opted to swap their business suits for boxing trunks at so-called white-collar fight nights. Only a Game's Charlie Schroeder recently invested some time at a fight night in Hong Kong, and he submits this return.
Okay, Paul, stop. Okay, so you're still lifting your elbows up. You got to pull your defense in and block, block, block.
That's Jordan Roberts, a boxing instructor here in Hong Kong. He's training the most unlikely of fighters, 29-year-old Christina Park, an internal systems consultant at BlackRock. She's not what you would call rough and tumble, more polite and brainy. She stands 5'3", which Roberts says is an advantage against taller opponents.
Keep your target small, yes. Stay shorter than these girls. You're shorter than them. They shouldn't be able to get to your body so easy.
It's a few days until Park's bout, a 3-round, 6-minute fight, which will take place at the 8th annual Hedge Fund Fight Night. Park, who grew up between Seoul, South Korea, and Fairfax, Virginia, has been training hard for the last 5 months.
I've been quite stressed out the past week just thinking about it. Like, I feel like I have to throw up thinking about the fight sometimes.
This year, 14 men and 2 women duke it out in front of an audience of 700, each of whom has coughed up $250 for the black tie event. It hasn't been an easy road for the participants. They've sacrificed a lot to get in shape. Alcohol, greasy foods, a social life. And the training has been harder than they could have imagined. This is how Patrick McGee, a journalist at the Financial Times and Fight Night boxer, describes it.
Just imagine doing the most intense cardio you can do, something like sprinting, but while somebody punches you in the face for 2 minutes, and they're knocking the wind out of you.
For Christina Park, who grew up playing water polo, that first hit to the face was a real doozy. Fortunately, it was delivered from an exceedingly polite sparring partner.
And she immediately jumped forward and said, "I'm so sorry, are you okay? Are you okay?" But I actually saw stars, so I had to like step back and I was like, "You just need to give me a minute." And that's when I kind of woke up and I was like, "Jesus, this is a contact sport. What did I sign myself up to?"
What she signed herself up for is Hedge Fund Fight Night, which takes place on the Hong Kong harborfront under the stars, or rather under a massive white tent that shields the crowd from an intermittent December rain. It's quite a setting. 54 tables packed with Hong Kong moneymakers dressed in tuxedos and fancy schmancy dresses. Look to the north, there's Victoria Harbor. To the south, a towering wall of glass skyscrapers.
It is Hong Kong picture postcard and sensational considering that all of these buildings are where most of these guys work.
That's Rob Derry, managing director of Ironmonger Events, the company that puts on Hedge Fund Fight Night. Derry came up with the idea in 2006 after hearing about a similar event in London. Derry tells me he considered holding fight nights for real estate and legal professionals as well, but they just didn't gravitate to it the way financial industry folks did.
I think finance, it's a pretty cutthroat business and very determined people who are in it, and that kind of person who's left their home to come here to succeed. A lot of that runs through in boxing.
Patrick McGee is one of them. The Financial Times journalist works in Hong Kong but hails from Canada. He says that fighting is primal and that the privileged participants may not have a whole lot of, real problems.
This is where the hashtag first world problems comes in. But we still have those human instincts, right? So creating a massive problem like this for yourself is sort of one way to be able to get out those, primal urges, if you will.
Primal urges in a sport where the odds aren't in your favor.
And one thing I like about this is most of the types that are actually doing this are analysts, These are people that are good with numbers. Well, the proposition of boxing is two men go out, and this is a 50% chance you're going to lose. I mean, how many trades do people put on where that's going to be the case? You know, I mean, the odds are really stacked against you.
In the red corner, fighting for BlackRock, please welcome to the ring, Christina Soul Snatcher Park!
Those low odds haven't stopped Christina Soul Snatcher Park, that's Seoul, South Korea, from trying her luck. But about 10 seconds into her fight against Stephanie the Trigger Tavoli, something does stop her. one of her contact lenses.
We interrupt the fight for a technical...
It's fallen out. Her trainer, Jordan Roberts, attempts to put it back in, but to no avail. Park may have trained 5 months for this moment, but she never thought she'd have to duck punches while she was essentially blind in one eye. But somehow, amazingly, she manages.
Oh, Christina got one in there on Stephanie's chin, swinging. Oh, got one then, right on the noggin.
By the middle of the third and final round, the two women are so tired they can barely keep their hands up. By the end of the fight, it actually hurts to watch them.
In a split decision, but by a majority, in the red corner, the Black Hawk, Christina Salstretcher Park.
Park raises her arms in victory. Later that night, she's out of her boxing gear and into formal attire, a red dress for the woman who was victorious in the red corner. After months of teetotaling, she's enjoying a glass of white wine. I ask her if she'll continue to box.
I'm interested, but at this point, I'm just trying to enjoy.
Enjoy your glass of wine.
Enjoy my glass of wine.
And really, who can blame her? For Only a Game, I'm Charlie Schroeder in Hong Kong.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is James Trout. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. We bid a fond adieu this week to our trusty intern, Eric Larrabee. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you're looking for a last-minute holiday gift for sports fans on your list, our featured books section is a great place to get ideas. You'll find our interviews with authors, my reviews, and excerpts from many of the books. Visit onlyagame.org and click on Featured Books. If you're looking for something a little sillier, actually a lot sillier, check out our 22nd annual Only a Game Holiday Gift Guide. You can see all of the goofy recommendations at onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes ringside from Hedge Fund Fight Night in Hong Kong. Oh, sounds like regulative legislation may have taken another one on the chin. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.